It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, in our studio, Dr. Eric Dykin, neurologist and director of the University of Iowa Sleep Disorders Center. Every few months, we like to have Dr. Dykin come into our studio to answer your questions about a sleep problem you've been having or share an unusual sleep experience and to have his take on some of the latest research on sleep disorders and what we're finding out about this mysterious world of slumber where most of us try to spend about a third of our lives. Dr. Dykin, welcome to our studio. I hope you got your third of your life in the last 24 hours spent in a good sleep.
Oh, yeah. New Year's resolution, most certainly.
All right. Join our conversation. As I said, your chance to get Dr. Dykin's tips for whatever sleep problem you're experiencing, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email river2river@iowapublicradio.org. Later in the hour, some of the research we'll be discussing is how insufficient sleep is one reason why disadvantaged groups have more heart disease, also how our deepest states of sleep are more apt to calm and reset an anxious brain. Anxiety disorder can be, sleep of course figures into that in a major way. Also, because it's our first show of 2020, we want to look back at this past decade and discuss with Dr. Dykin all the ways in which we now better understand the role of good sleep in avoiding some very serious health consequences. We do have a greater understanding over the last few years. If you've been listening to the Dr. Dykin, he's been with us
121 shows.
121 shows, I think, is the tally now. 1-866-780-9100. But first, let's talk about sleep paralysis. Have you ever been falling asleep or perhaps waking up and then suddenly aware you're unable to move, unable to speak? This is sleep paralysis, and we wanted to discuss what causes this, what we're learning about it. But first of all, perhaps let's hear from someone recounting an instance of sleep paralysis from NPR Shortwave Podcast. Josh Smith from Orange, California, describing not only paralysis but a terrifying hallucination. One night when he was 16, he woke up in the pitch black, unable to move his body. Josh said he felt having a huge amount of pressure on his chest and thought even that he was being attacked by a demon.
I couldn't move my head, couldn't move my arms, my legs. And I could sense there was a presence in the room. And I, you know, started freaking out because I couldn't move, I couldn't speak. It was humanoid and it was pale white, like no pigment in the skin. No eyebrows, you know, no facial hair, no nothing. But the eyes, I remember very specifically that whatever this thing was, the eyes were the deepest of deep, this darkness. It stayed there for maybe 15, 20 seconds. And then, you know, growing up in an evangelical home, you know, I was told, hey, just say the name of Jesus, you know. So I started saying the name of Jesus over and over and over, and then it went away, and I woke up.
Okay, Josh Smith recounting his instance of sleep paralysis. We could also categorize that, I suppose, as a night terror with that hallucination in it. Join our conversation. Perhaps you've had some sort of similar experience. 1-866-780-9100. Let's set the hallucination to the side for the moment. Have you address that in a moment, Dr. Dykin. What is the body doing? And I think almost all of us have had this experience upon waking or falling asleep. You find yourself paralyzed.
Yeah. Well, we've captured that and we've published that. And they're publishing videos nowadays. And in the Atlas of Sleep Medicine a few years back, we actually demonstrated one of our patients having this. So we've captured during sleep studies these sleep paralytic events. And electrographically, the brain waves are in REM, dreaming or paralyzed sleep. But in reality, consciously, the patients are relatively awake And as such, they may have a little bit of a hallucinatory element, a frightening element, like a dreamlike state, but they know they're awake, very, very frightening, and they're paralyzed because that's part of normal REM, rapid eye movement, dreaming, or paralyzed sleep.
Mm-hmm. So you, your body in normal sleep, when you go into deep sleep, it paralyzes you to what? What would be the reason for that?
So simplistically, so you don't act out your dreams, because there's a pathology called the REM sleep behavior disorder that older guys get, especially people who are developing Parkinson's disease, where this inhibition of movement is destroyed and they can act out their dreams and they can be very violent, hurt themselves and their family members.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about these sorts of instances of sleep paralysis, is it more likely? We know nightmares and sleepwalking are more common among the young. Is that also true of sleep paralysis, this frightening experience of not being able to move a arm, a leg, speak?
They say it is. Recently, they say maybe. But people under stress or under pressure. And the more I pay attention to it, sleep deprivation, I've had sleep paralysis. And a good friend of ours who you've all have quoted indicated, Dr. Kishida from Stanford, says maybe 8%. I think it's more like 40% if we think about it and we're really sleep deprived, have had a time when we're not quite awake, not quite asleep, and you just can't move, or you're in a dream and you just can't move. That's probably elements of sleep paralysis. Maybe up to 8 to 40% of all of us at least once in our life have to sleep deprivation.
But there it does coincide with periods of stress, perhaps. Maybe you're not getting enough sleep.
Absolutely, because if you're under stress, it's probably the number one problem causing insomnia, difficult maintaining or getting to sleep in the world. If you're wired out, you're not going to fall asleep. And there's a lot of stress nowadays.
Mm-hmm. There's a cultural element to this. Night hag or old hag, these are names that have been given to this supposed supernatural creature used to explain the phenomenon of sleep paralysis in centuries past. So it was explained as some sort of malevolent supernatural creature on you, and we certainly heard that in that firsthand experience there as well. So again, why would we in this state sometimes hallucinate something in our room, something as frightening as being on our chest, weighing our chest down?
Well, during REM sleep, dreaming sleep, paralyzed sleep, the vision center of the brain is stimulated. The auditory part of the brain is stimulated, and the movement center, the vestibular center, is stimulated. So most dreams are composed of vision, hearing, and movement. So when you're in and out of this REM-like state, and you're starting to wake up, but you're not quite out of REM, you hear, see, and maybe feel things. So this old hag that you talked about, there's a quote from Shakespeare, from Romeo and Juliet, and he says, "This is the hag, when maids lie on their back, that presses them and learns them first to bear, making them women of good carriage." So even Shakespeare was talking about, and so we want to make sure we're not too chauvinistic. They thought this was a demon sitting on their chest, not allowing them to breathe. So it's often even worse lying flat on your back.
Interesting. So in our day and age, what would you say as a sleep specialist, how frequent would these sleep paralysis need to be for you to, you would say, well, you need to seek some treatment for that? It happens to most people sometimes during their lifetime, but some people have it very frequently at certain periods.
When it bothers you. And when it bothers you, and as my good friend Cleet Kishida from Stanford had said, there's another element that interferes with sleep, like obstructive sleep apnea. It occurs mostly, worstly, if you will, if that's even a word, in REM paralyzed sleep, where the throat is a little bit looser and it tends to close off. And during REM sleep and during an apnea, you can have a very bad dream and try to wake up from it, feel a little paralyzed. If that occurs over and over, it may be more likely that you have obstructive sleep apnea, with over 18 million people in the United States have, and can kill people dead, like Princess Leia, Carrie Fisher, one of my favorite actresses. You know, we were Star Wars fans. She died falling asleep from an apneic event. Sure, she was on medications and other things, sedatives, but that can mimic sleep paralysis. If you have that enough to bother you, go right to your healthcare professional, and I'd have a sleep study, make sure you don't have obstructive sleep apnea.
Okay. Join our conversation. Dr. Eric Daikin, a neurologist, a director of the University of Iowa Sleep Disorders Center. This is your chance to tell us about a sleep problem you've been having, perhaps an unusual sleep experience, or perhaps a remedy for good sleep that you have discovered that others may benefit from. We're open to all kinds of questions and comments about your sleep and getting better sleep. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, if you like, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to some of the research within the last couple of months in the area of sleep research, Dr. Daikin, before we go to our callers. This is new research from the European Society of Cardiology. Insufficient sleep, one reason why disadvantaged groups have more heart disease. This is the finding of a study published in Cardiovascular Research. This is a journal of the European Society of Cardiology. You've had a look at least a summary of this study. Walk us through, if you could, what they looked at and what they found here.
Well, we know that in this study in Europe, males 20 to 64 in semi or unskilled occupations have three times higher risk for premature death from cardiovascular disease compared to professionals in managerial positions. So they looked at the sleep of these people. And what they found, men really more than women, those men who were of lower social economic standards, according to what I just described, they may get less sleep for a lot of reasons. Stress, pressure, their financial situation, shift work, several jobs, living in noisy, unprotected environments with crime. So they looked at that, and when they sort of looked at all the variable confounding factors, they thought that short sleep explained 13.4% of the link between their occupation and coronary artery disease, but this was in men. Primarily, women seem to be a bit more protected for a lot of hypothesized reasons. But again, we could go on and on about that.
Mm-hmm. So we have yet another, and we have a long list of ways in which poor sleep can really have adverse effects in areas you might not think. Heart disease, for instance.
Absolutely.
Okay. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to our first caller. Gene is with us from Cedar Rapids. Gene, welcome to the program.
Thank you. When I was a kid, this happened to me all the time. I was probably 12, 13, and I would not wake up, and I would be stuck, paralyzed. Mm-hmm. And after it was over, I'd always ask my mother, why didn't you come? Why didn't you come? I was screaming for you. Hmm. And she never came because she didn't hear me because I wasn't screaming.
And that was terrifying, I have to believe.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it happened a lot. And I do have sleep apnea now, and I've been treating with CPAP for several years. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's a connection there, but boy, oh boy. Yeah, things were stressful at home, but I slept a lot. I slept 12 hours a night, so I wasn't under sleeping.
Right. When we're waking or falling asleep, you know, we have a sort of a different sense of time. I wonder, Gene, if you could tell us when you had your worst bouts of sleep paralysis, how long would you estimate that paralysis lasted?
Well, I have no idea because I couldn't see a clock, you know, when
it started. But I've experienced it, but it has been only a matter of seconds when I'm trying to move and can't move. But yours sounds like if your mother was calling, you were not answering, it sounds like it could be quite a lengthy paralysis.
No, it's the other way around. I was calling her, and she didn't hear me because I wasn't actually being vocal. I was trying to get help, but, of course, I wasn't really screaming.
I see. I see. Dr. Dykin, what's your take on this?
Was your age or was treatment of apnea associated with any change in the frequency of these sleep paralytic events?
No, they only happened when I was a kid living at home. They haven't happened in the subsequent years.
Yeah, and there's something to aging. You know, they say that these are often problems of younger people, but I tell you, I have pretty bad apnea. And without my therapy, I think I have an increased risk of these sleep paralytic events. In our young man, that we actually have a video in the Atlas of Sleep Medicine. People can, it's a pretty expensive book, but you can get that video online. He had a small apnea right before the event. And the apneas are usually worse, frequently worse, in REM sleep. And he might have been dreaming, and there might have been this parallel when he's waking up, still with the hallucinatory event, and then trying to call out on our video. He's trying, he's contacted our tech, he's shaking his head, and he's quite aware. But then there's the phenomena we were intervening, and his was about 7 minutes in duration. So how do you tell? And if they last long enough, you often go back to sleep, and then it's really difficult to tell.
Mm. Gene, thanks for sharing. Any idea why did it subside, when it subsided as a young woman?
I have no idea. Things were tough at home, but I didn't leave till I was 17 or 18, so
okay.
It stopped somewhere along the line.
All right.
But it's really just very nice to hear this validated and explained. That's what I wanted to say.
Well, that's what we're here for.
Well, good for us.
thank you, Gene.
Yeah,
that's what we're here for describing your experience. Gene in Cedar Rapids explaining, describing some instances of sleep paralysis she had as a young woman. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Juliana, is in Des Moines. Hi, Juliana. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to make a comment and have a question about narcolepsy and cataplexy. I just wanted to encourage your listeners to have a sleep study done. I got diagnosed with narcolepsy and cataplexy not until I was in my mid-40s, but I knew my whole life that I had something. I didn't know what it was, but the interesting part about sleep disorders is you're sleeping, so you don't really know. You know, your sleep is your sleep, and somebody else's sleep is different, and that doesn't make it necessarily a disorder. It's just something. And so if you don't realize something is going on, then these sleep studies that you go through, you have to jump through quite a few hoops. But I have a question about the genetic nature of narcolepsy and cataplexy. My daughter is now having some sleep issues, and she went and had a sleep study done, and we've heard that narcolepsy is genetic, and she has gotten diagnosed with sleep apnea, and she's trying to use the CPAP machine, but it's very difficult for a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And so just what the doctor's thoughts are on the genetic state of these sleep disorders and how you can kind of get through. Insurance kind of makes you jump through a lot of hoops for sleep apnea. You have to kind of get diagnosed with one before you can move on to the next.
Yep.
And kind of navigating those and
okay.
And being patient.
We'll get you an answer, Juliana. I'm going to put you on hold, but I would like to have Dr. Dykin, because you mentioned narcolepsy and cataplexy, not terms that everyone knows. Short definitions of those, Dr. Dykin.
Well, and why does it follow on the feet of sleep paralysis? Well, sleep paralysis traditionally is found as a normal component of narcolepsy. So narcolepsy are people who are genetically prone, for a variety of reasons, to being pathologically sleepy. And they often have sleepiness, sleep attacks. They'll have sleep paralysis. During those sleep paralytic events, they'll have hallucinations, the hypnagogic hallucinations. Because they're sleeping all day, they paradoxically have insomnia at night, so they sound like, well, you're not making sense to me when they go to see a healthcare professional. You're not sleeping at night. You need to sleep more during the day. And, but doctor, that's what my problem is. I'm sleeping all day.
Yeah.
And then the last one is cataplexy. So These are all inappropriate intrusions that you can't help when REM sleep happens. And cataplexy, for some reason, give a strong positive emotion, make the patient laugh, and REM sleep will, bam, occur right away with its paralysis. So you can be laughing in a group of people and you'll fall to the ground because normal REM sleep is associated with paralysis. And it's just potentially dangerous. Do that in a bathtub. And you'll drown.
So what is the treatment for that?
Well, modafinil is the first FDA-approved medication for that. It's a central nervous system stimulant. We use other types of central nervous stimulants to replace what the body may be missing, which is a neurotransmitter called orexin, hypocretin. So we use a specific central nervous system stimulant to replace what the body is missing.
Okay. Juliana's question also about her daughter. Her daughter diagnosed with sleep apnea, having trouble getting used to a CPAP machine. Now, that is a common theme, right? They are a wonderful device, a wonderful invention, but for some, it's really hard to accommodate them in your bedroom.
Well, let me plug this. On Thursday, on the 30th, at 6 o'clock, at Iowa River Landing, we're going to have four different major therapeutic options for obstructive sleep apnea with experts from the University of Iowa and around the Midwest talking about not only the CPAP, the PAP, positive airway pressure therapies for sleep apnea, access assistant to keep your airways open, but we're going to have Dr. Parker from the University of Iowa College of Dentistry, who's going to talk about oral devices, which pulls your jaw forward, opens up the throat. We're going to talk about Dr. Van Dale from otolaryngology, using hypoglossal nerve stimulation, and we're also going to talk about respicare people who do diaphragmatic stimulation to keep the airways open.
And this is open to the public?
Open to the public. Yeah, bring your friends, family, because okay. We all got apnea.
How do people find, is there a way on the web that people can find out more information just listening in their cars right now, for instance?
Right now, I think you can contact Dr. Amy Perlman at the Department of Urology. It's the Men's Health program that she holds every month at the Iowa River Landing.
Okay, very good. We'll be back with Dr. Eric Dyken, neurologist, director of the University of Iowa Sleep Disorders Center. More of your questions about sleep, sleep problems, unusual sleep experiences. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back with Dr. Dyken and more sleep problems and solutions in just a moment.
So tired, my mind is set on you. I wonder, should I call you?
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, my guest, Iowa native Chris Liddell Westerfeld. It was in 2007 that Chris became a field organizer for the Obama campaign. Well, he went on to spend 5 years on the White House staff during the Obama administration. He has a book out. It's called They Said This Day Would Never Come. So tomorrow on the program, he'll share his campaign experiences. Hard to believe that campaign now 12 years in the past. And he'll give us his thoughts on the current campaign season as well tomorrow on River to River. Today, it's all about sleep, good sleep, crummy sleep, trying to make that crummy sleep better sleep, and also the latest research from the world of sleep. Dr. Eric Dyken is joining us of the University of Iowa Sleep Disorders Center. He's director there. So we're taking your calls, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. If you'd like to email us with your question or sleep problem, you can do that, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. In the last half hour, if you were with us, we spoke with Juliana, I believe, from the Des Moines area. She was asking about the genetic component of narcolepsy and something called cataplexy. You wanted to finish up there, Dr. Dyken, before we moved on to other callers.
Yeah, and there are actually tests we can do that are really associated with the tendency to get narcolepsy, and it's a human leukocyte antigen, an HLA marker, genetic marker called DQB 0602. So
is everyone writing this down?
Yeah, write that down. But I mean, but there is a tendency, and they really believe that tendency is associated with a chance to get a viral infection as a young person. And when this virus infects you, it will go to the center for stimulating wakefulness in your brain, the lateral hypothalamus, and it will recognize it as being abnormal. And during that flu, it will kill off those cells and leave you sleepy. And that's why we need to replace what is missing in these patients and why there's a genetic tendency for some people to develop it.
Okay, Juliana, thank you for that question. Very interesting there. Let's go back to our phones, 1-866-780-9100. Ed has been waiting in Waterloo. Thanks for waiting, Ed. What is your sleep problem or comment here?
Well, I'm curious, is there a reasonable surgery that could be done in lieu of the CPAP?
Okay.
I'm not a fan of those.
Yep. I don't know if anybody is. The device itself, it's a wonderful device in terms of bringing sleep to people who've had poor sleep for years or even decades. This is the floppy throat thing that happens, Dr. Daikin. We talk about it. You're a specialist in this area. Could you just get a surgery, have some of that whatever flab in the back of your throat cut out?
Well,
or your tonsils removed.
When I started in this field, the treatment of choice for sleep apnea was a tracheostomy. That'll take care of that obstruction. And
a tracheostomy is what?
A hole in the trachea right there.
Oh,
sort of cover it up with the high button. I mean, there was not a lot of people standing in line to have a hole put in their trachea, so you would breathe around that issue.
Mm-hmm.
But that was years and years ago, and people would rather die than have that in some cases. Although in some severe cases of sleep apnea, that can be life-threatening and a temporary therapy. That was followed by a uvulopalatopharyngoplasty, which means all the junk in the back of your throat, the uvula little thing hangs down in the back
sure.
of your throat.
Yep.
You get 50 points on a far side, you know, exam. all the extra stuff in the back of your throat. They cut all of that out and maybe open up the throat so you have less apnea. Didn't work so well. Hurts like stink if you've ever had a tonsillectomy, adenoidectomy. And if you're a singer, all that extra tissue, those are resonators. It could destroy a career if you're a speaker, a singer, an actor.
So to answer Ed in Waterloo, surgery is not the way to go here.
Well, if you have a problem with the face, if you have a genetic, and a lot of our kids, the developmental disability that my wife sees, Deborah Lynn Dyken, who sees these pediatric sleep disorders over here at the U, they all often have genetic concomitant where they can do advancement of the face over multiple surgeries, and it opens up what we call the anterior airway space. So in some specific cases, there are a variety of surgeries, but I don't think that's what Ed's problems are. There's also a laser that they'll do and try to burn out pieces at a time of extra tissue in the back of the throat. But the surgeries, they change the way you speak. They can change the way you swallow. Your carotid artery is back there. There's the risk of surgery and the anesthesia. And it's usually not utilized too often.
Okay. Ed, I think you're still on the line. Dr. Daikin can tell you if you're not having success with your CPAP or your – what can Ed do? Ed, you're still there, right?
I am.
What can Ed do to be happier with his CPAP, or are there other solutions?
Well, on January the 30th at 6 o'clock, we're going to have a bunch of experts talk about other therapies. This includes oral devices, hypoglossal nerve stimulatory therapies that will actually open up the throat when you sleep, positional therapies. So there are other therapies out there. So if you can't tolerate PAP, a lot of our soldiers who have been over in Afghanistan, etc., they've been used to the gas mask and they have claustrophobia. They cannot wear a CPAP mask. So, yes, we do have other therapy.
Well, Ed, I hope it gives you something to go on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ed in Waterloo. And let's go quickly to some, to have you touch on some research that has happened in the last or has been announced in the last few weeks. This is from the University of California at Berkeley. Researchers finding that a type of sleep most apt to calm and reset anxious anxiety in people is deep sleep. Now, this makes sense. This is the journal Nature Human Behavior published on November 4th. So deep sleep. So what do we know? What is this telling you about the connection between anxiety, anxiety disorder, when it really gets out of hand, and deep sleep here?
Well, what they showed is they let people get, I think there was 18 young adults, and they let them get really good sleep, a full night's of sleep, well over 8 hours, or else like no sleep at all, very, very, very little sleep. And what they did was these functional MRIs, these imaging studies of the brain that can show different activity levels in the brain, and the sleep studies. So the longer you slept and the more deep sleep, and they call this non-REM, slow wave sleep, a very synchronized, high amplitude brainwave activity that many people think is our most satisfying, our deeper, more restful stage of sleep. The more you got of that, the next day, after all that anxiety, you get the imaging study of your brain, and your brain looks like it's functioning normal. The people who had very little sleep, very little slow wave sleep, they had no activity, a shutdown, if you will, of the medial prefrontal cortex, which normally, as they state, keeps anxiety in check. While deeper emotional centers, the limbic portions of the brain, they call them, were overactive. So that's what they saw in this study. But I think it almost makes common sense. If you get a good night of sleep, why do you feel so good? When you get no sleep, why do you feel so bad? Well, this took it and sort of objectified it.
1-866-780-9100, a good number of callers, and we've got some emails as well. Let's fire through these as rapidly as possible. If we could, Dr. Daikin, let's go to Lyle. Lyle's been waiting in Richland, Iowa, which is in the southeast corner of the state, right, Lyle? That's where you are?
Yeah, that's correct.
All right. What's your sleep problem?
Well, I don't have one. I sleep like a good steak, and I just love it.
Oh,
but I'm lucky,
good for you.
Because my wife very often cannot get to sleep at all during the night. She tries, but she's just tossing and turning. And finally she says, you know, forget it. And she gets out her Kindle. And about 6 or 7 in the morning, she goes to sleep. And then she sleeps for 8-9 hours. She's tried to change the pattern, but it just doesn't seem to work. It's very, very ingrained. So what do you do?
What do you do, Dr. Daikin?
Well, I would see your healthcare professional first. And again, you have to have a full history. You have to look under the hood, too, and do the examination. But if I was just thinking off the top, she stays up really, really late, goes to sleep, and she probably sleeps in really, really long. And there are some people who are wired, and especially young adolescents, when we call it delayed sleep phase syndrome, compared to typical middle age and older adults. Young people tend to stay up much later. They're not sleepy until late into the evening or early morning hours. And as such, they tend to sleep in much, much longer. And that's called delayed phase syndrome. But there are a lot of different things that can keep you from falling asleep. Stress, pressure, probably underlying thoughts. And it's probably the number one cause of insomnia, difficulty getting to sleep. So before listening to somebody give you this spiel on the radio, I'd sit down and talk about stress and pressure, delayed phase syndrome, and possibly could you have other sleep-related problems like sleep apnea with your healthcare professional, your APP, a PAC, an ARNP, a MD, a DO, someone who is trained in sleep medicine, and then go from there. But it does seem like it's something new, something concerning, and as such, I don't think she was born this way, like a delayed phase syndrome person would have been. I think you bring those words to your local healthcare professional and then go from there.
Okay. Thank you, Lyle, for that question from Richland. Let's swing from the southeast part of the state over to the northwest part. Katie is with us in Storm Lake. Hi, Katie. Coming up to the end of the hour, I'll ask you to be concise, but what's your question? I hope you're... we've got a remedy for any sleep problem you might have.
Hi. So my husband has non-epileptic seizures, which I'm sure we're all aware those are psychiatric. And you're not supposed to have non-epileptic seizures when you're asleep. But it seems like my husband will have a bad dream And when he's thrown out of sleep and he'll be having a non-epileptic seizure or hallucinating or something is psychiatrically wrong when he wakes up. Can you tell me anything about that and what's going on?
Well, it's interesting. There are sleep-related eating disorders that you've probably heard about. There are sleep-related violent behaviors that you may have also heard about on, you know, 60 Minutes and a bunch of these television medical science documentary things. So oftentimes people with psychiatric issues can have a tendency to have arousals from sleep with this sleep overlay where they're actually awake and then their behaviors essentially are precipitated by the sleep itself but continue in the waking state. So it's not necessarily a normal thing, but sleep can precipitate things like the sleep disorder eating problem. Because when these patients are awake after waking up, they're continuing to eat in the waking state, but it's just not a normal phenomenon. So these pseudo spells or these non-epileptic seizures, sleep can provide a platform like the sleep-related eating disorder, like the sleep-related violence, for a sleep-related behavior to continue during the waking states.
Mm. Okay. Katie, I hope that gives you something to go on in Storm Lake there.
Yes, that does. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie in Storm Lake. Let's dive right over to Hubbard in the central part of the state. Brenda is with us in Hubbard. Hi. Welcome to the program, Brenda.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I'll just make this quickly as I can. When I was in middle school, I did have this going on with me, okay? And I can remember I could see everything going on. I just couldn't move.
Hold on, Brenda. What was going on?
Well, I could move.
Sleep paralysis.
Yes, I am sorry. And it seemed like there was a lot of noise for some reason or other going on, and I would yell for my father. Because it was, I guess, as a kid, it's easy, you know, daddy, daddy, daddy. And then I guess I got so loud, he eventually heard me, and boy, he'd come running, wake me, shake me, wake me, and everything was okay. But I was very frightened. Now, as I got older, that all went away. I never had it. But I say, I don't know, 20, 30 years passed, because I'm in my 70s now. And sometimes I would feel one of those coming on as I began to fall asleep. I would shake myself and wake myself up, so I got to where I could control it, and that it doesn't happen anymore, which I'm happy.
Good for you.
Well,
so
good.
I thought that was kind of unusual, that I could feel it before as I started to fall asleep, is what I'm trying to say.
Hmm. Yeah, we call that hypnagogic going into sleep, hypnopompic if it's coming out of sleep. It, more frequently, it's hypnagogic, the sleep paralytic. And oftentimes, when you're sleep-deprived, you'll go right into REM or paralyzed sleep. But what you've described is you are a lucid dreamer. You have control over your REM sleep. And there are a lot of people who can actually train at Stanford sleep centers how to play with their dreams. And you're a lucid dreamer. That's pretty cool.
Brenda, thank you for your call from Hubbard, Iowa. Coming up to the end of our hour, but we have time enough for Afok. I hope I'm getting your name right, Afok, in Hiawatha. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. So I wanted to ask about dreams and basically what exactly determines like the length and the exhaustiveness, because I have long exhausting dreams throughout the whole night and wake up exhausted even if I'm sleeping 8-9 hours.
Wow.
So like, is there anything to do with like, I don't know, diet or
so?
I'm sure like there's many factors.
These dreams are exhausting you. Do you have common themes quickly before we hand it over to Dr. Dykin? Do things repeat themselves? What are you running away? You say you're exhausted. Are you running away from something or somebody?
No, they're usually just elaborate stories, random, like almost like I'm watching a whole movie.
Hmm. Okay. Hmm.
Well, you know, there's a lot of theories about REM sleep, dreaming sleep. And we know that we often can encode memory. And often the theory is from Ashkenazi and Carla McGregor here at the University of Iowa is that you take recent memories and you review them and you dump out the stuff you don't want and you keep the stuff that you need. When we're under stress, for example, nightmare and anxiousness and exhausting dreams can really occur as part of normal concomitant of this 24-hour-a-day society we have with an industrialized Western society. But there is a phenomenon called the activation synthesis hypothesis that we see with REM sleep and sleep apnea, where if you really stop breathing, and I've lived through this, the brain doesn't like that, and it'll construct a dream around the apnea that you're drowning. And I've had that twice. So there can be a lot of associations with uncomfortable dreams. And my thoughts, if you're under stress, you're under pressure, and you're handling it, well, great. If you're not, and you're having worse and worse dreams, and if you ever wake up like you're drowning from a dream, go see your healthcare professional, right. Have them take a look down your throat, look for the whole story, see if you need a sleep study to rule out apnea or other health-related issues.
Okay. Afok, thank you very much for your call. I think we had on an earlier show, Dr. Daikin, not the drowning version, but the python around the neck version. Yeah. Do you remember that? So your brain can make up all kinds of things. We have a minute or two left. Let's sneak in this email from Mary in Iowa City. We need a quick answer for this for Mary. She writes, does very loud snoring, verified by more than one family member, she says, indicate sleep apnea? A member of my family has done both a home sleep study kit and an overnight sleep study, and it was determined he did not have sleep apnea. He hasn't slept well for a period of years, so they were surprised he wasn't diagnosed. What do you make of that?
No, you could have loud snoring. I think 30 to 40% of the male population between 30 and 60, something like this, has significant snoring. Third-party payers think that it's a cosmetic problem, but it can lead to high-frequency hearing loss. It can disrupt your sleep. You think it's bothering your family, your bed partner, it's right in between your ears. But it is one of those associates with obstructive sleep apnea. But no, you can have loud snoring in and of itself.
Mm. And as we close, I noticed NBC News had a recent article under the headline, 9 science-backed wellness trends from the last decade that we're taking into the 2020s. Of course, we want to look over the past decade in science research. They listed number 2 for wellness trends, number 2, the rebranding of sleep. They're saying we've learned so much in the last decade. We've gone from we've grown out of I'll sleep when I'm dead sort of attitude to, hey, sleep is really, really important in a myriad of ways, Dr. Daikin.
Older population, higher risk of Alzheimer's disease. They think that the slow wave sleep, the more sleep you get, you bathe all those brain cells, take out the beta lipoprotein, reduce your risk of Alzheimer's, live longer, live better. I'm sort of putting the spin on what you're talking about, a lot of good things. And if we could have prevented Princess Leia from dying from her apnea, I think a lot of Star Wars fans would be a lot happier, including John Candy, Andre the Giant, Jerry Garcia, Reggie White, a lot of people we've lost, my cousin, my uncle, and again, the memorial that we're having right now for the Zolos who lost a son. From sleep apnea.
So, yeah, we've had them on a previous show. Very important to address sleep problems, especially when it involves depriving what is, when in sleep apnea, depriving your brain of needed oxygen, right?
Right.
Your blood oxygen level literally drops, and your body reacts to it and wakes you up and keeps you from getting a good night's sleep. Here's one, a broad question as we finish this first sleep show of 2020. I'm going to have a pie chart. And you slice, how big is the slice of pie about when we talk about sleep science, our understanding of sleep? How much do we understand in that pie? Is that 30%, 40%, 50%? What's unknown and what's known in sleep science?
Itty bitty 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 bit of that pie. I mean, we're talking about
a little slice.
Oh, man, neuronal regeneration possibly in REM sleep and making little kids walk again.
Well, that's also, I asked that question because we need to have you back because there'll be more sleep research revealed for you to comment on it. Thank you, Dr. Daikin.
My pleasure.
Dr. Eric Dykin, neurologist, director of the University of Iowa Sleep Disorders Center. Love to have him in, answer your questions. Thanks for all the callers and the emails. River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Rick Brewer, and Caitlin Harrop. Julia DiGiacomo helped us as well today. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer, wishing you a wonderful night's sleep.